KALW.
I want to give Kamala credit for this. It's a knife fight in a phone booth.
San Francisco is a small city, but it's produced some of the nation's biggest political names, including Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris.
She united somehow Pacific Heights High Society, African Americans in the Bayview, and LGBT community in the Castro.
She is the first woman and first person of color to serve as the city's district attorney, and she's had a reputation for being tough on crime.
So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy. Well, this was a little controversial in San Francisco.
As voters make up their minds, we're revisiting a series that looks back at Kamala Harris's early days in politics. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Democratic National Convention started today. Historically, they've marked significant moments for women in politics. It was in 1984 in San Francisco that presidential nominee Walter Mondale announced Geraldine Ferraro as his running mate, making her the first woman on a major presidential ticket.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro. Before you to proclaim tonight, America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us.
Forty years later, we're seeing another first. The first time a woman of color is at the top of the ticket, and it's Oakland's very own Kamala Harris. Her life in public office has been scrutinized on a national level ever since she was named vice president. But some folks are asking, who is she and what does she stand for? So today, we're revisiting a podcast produced by our friends at the San Francisco Chronicle back in 2020. It digs into the life and career of Vice President Kamala Harris, and it starts 20 years ago when Harris first became the city's district attorney. Here's episode one of Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris?
First of all, the church was absolutely jam-packed. I don't know how many it holds. I would guess it holds somewhere around 3,000 people. And when you stuffed them all in there, there was at least 1,000 cops in uniform.
It's April 16th, 2004, at St. Mary's Church in San Francisco, the funeral of Officer Isaac Espinosa, a popular young cop who'd been shot and killed. Kamala Harris, the new district attorney, had already announced she wouldn't seek the death penalty against the suspect in the shooting, a gang member. She had been endorsed by the police union in her upset win against incumbent Terrence Hallinan, a progressive who the cops saw as soft on crime. He was known to seek options other than prosecution and jail time for offenses like prostitution and drug possession. Harris campaigned against him, saying she would be smart on crime. But like Hallinan and the other candidate in the race, a defense attorney named Bill Fazio, she also said she was against the death penalty. Even still, the announcement she would not seek it in this case shocked the cops. And that day, at Espinosa's jam-packed funeral,
the cops were livid.
Gary Delanis was president of the San Francisco Police Officers Association.
Some of it was emotional because, you know, the reality was that, and I think it was Kamala's position, and rightly so, they weren't going to give the death penalty to this guy. There was no way. I mean, I don't think San Francisco would give the death penalty to Charles Manson. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So from a logical perspective, she was right. But it was the way she handled it, the way it played out. She made these decisions, first of all, before the kid was even buried, which I thought was extremely inappropriate. And secondly, she never spoke to the family.
One of the speakers at the funeral was Senator Dianne Feinstein, the state's most powerful Democratic politician and the former mayor of San Francisco.
You know, I didn't, nobody knew what Feinstein was going to say. Feinstein had always been pro-cop. You know, she had always been very supportive of the SFPD. And to this day, she remains, although she's remained pretty quiet on all this stuff that's been happening lately, but she, you know, blurted out that I don't remember what her exact words were, that, you know, this is definitely a death penalty case or something like that. And she looked right at Kamala when she said it. And the cops just all rose to their feet. It was a standing ovation for about 5 minutes for Feinstein.
San Francisco. It's one of the world's great cities, but in a lot of ways, it's just like a million other towns. One of those ways is politics. They're brutal, parochial, often personal. Or as Harris's friend and fellow prosecutor Susie Loftus puts it,
it's been described, I think I want to give Kamala credit for this, it's a knife fight in a phone booth.
It's a small city, about 49 square miles. Staten Island is bigger. There's more than 800,000 people here, so of course everybody doesn't know everybody. But it can seem that way, especially in political circles where you won't find many Republicans. That liberal hothouse has produced some of the nation's biggest political names. Dianne Feinstein, Nancy Pelosi, Jerry Brown, more recently Gavin Newsom, and Kamala Harris. Most anywhere else, Kamala Harris would be so liberal as to be out of the mainstream, a left winger. In San Francisco, she won that first race by running as a centrist to the right of Terrence Hallinan, a veteran of the 1960s civil rights protests in San Francisco and Mississippi. Harris was a protest veteran too, but as she is fond of saying, she went to them in a stroller.
She grew up in the late 60s and early 70s in a city that was exploding with free speech, anti-war, and Black Power activism. The daughter of progressive academics, both of them immigrants. She played at a community center where Maya Angelou or Nina Simone might casually walk through the front door. After spending her teenage years in Montreal, she became politically active herself when she was a student at historically Black Howard University.
Howard University is one of the most important aspects of my life.
Today, she has one of the most consistently progressive voting records in the U.S. Senate. None of that sounds like the resume of someone who'd spend a decade and a half as what she calls the top cop, district attorney, and then state attorney general. So who's the real Kamala Harris, the progressive or the cop? And what can we learn from her childhood, her career, and the people who know her, about how she became the Democratic vice presidential nominee, the first African-American woman, and the first Asian-American on a major party ticket? That's what this podcast is about.
Yes or no?
Daughter of Oakland, California.
Sir, I'm asking a question.
I say we fight.
And that little girl was me.
I'm Joe Garofoli.
And I'm Tal Copen. And this is Chronicled. Who is Kamala Harris? From the San Francisco Chronicle. Episode 1, The Top Cop. Those of us in D.C., where, for our listeners who don't know, I cover politics for the Chronicle, tend to have a stereotype in our heads of a San Francisco Democrat, many of whom today are women. In fact, Republicans make attack ads based on it. But Kamala Harris first ran for office in 2003. Was that the case back then?
It's true, Tal. As you know, San Francisco loves to pat itself on the back as a progressive haven. But in fact, it was a bit of a boys' club. A Black woman running for office always knows the sexist and racist attacks are inevitable. And San Francisco is no exception. And this wasn't long after the 1990s, which was a time of rising crime and a massive federal tough-on-crime approach that has since fallen out of fashion.
But her position on policing wasn't what got attention in the race, was it?
No. The biggest target on Kamala Harris's back as she entered the race for district attorney in 2003 was a relationship she'd had a decade earlier. She was an assistant DA in Alameda County when, for about a year, she dated Willie Brown. At that time, he was the Speaker of the Assembly. In 2003, he was the outgoing mayor of San Francisco. She was single and he was married, though he'd been separated from his wife for years. The relationship resulted in Harris's first appearance in the Chronicle and a condescending gossip item in Herb Kane's column in 1994. Kane made note of the fact that Harris is Black and that she was, quote, a woman, not a girl. Brown had appointed Harris to two state commissions and introduced her to the city's upper crust, things he did for plenty of other qualified politicians that he didn't date, including, he says, Newsom, Pelosi, and Feinstein. Still, the arrows were coming for Harris.
They attacked her once.
That's Jim Stearns, who managed her 2003 campaign. The attack came in May, when the three candidates were together for a debate. There was Harris, who was polling in the single digits. There was Terrence Hallinan, the former boxer and civil rights stalwart nicknamed KO, now a two-term DA. Harris had worked for him briefly before moving to the city attorney's office. And there was Bill Fazio, a defense attorney and former prosecutor who had suffered narrow defeats to Hallinan in the two previous elections. He was a favorite of the local police union.
And so a member of the audience, probably planted by one of the campaigns, said, "What about Willie Brown?"
Harris had an answer ready. It was the kind of race Hallinan and Fazio had run against each other in 1995 and 99. And as far as Harris was concerned, well, they were welcome to it.
She stood behind Terrence and she said, "So you'll all remember, you know, that Fazio attacked Terrence for being a deadbeat dad who had to be sued to determine the paternity of his own child and make child payments." And then she went behind Fazio and she said, "And you'll remember how Terrence Hallinan attacked Fazio for being caught in a massage parlor during a police sting." And then she stood in the middle again. She says, "But I'm just not going to talk about that kind of stuff in this campaign, because I think you deserve a district attorney who's focused on the issues." And the whole crowd just spontaneously gave her a standing ovation.
The counterpunch worked. Harris moved ahead of Fazio and forced a runoff with Hallinan, and she won it handily. It was an upset, and it was national news. She was the first woman and the first person of color to serve as San Francisco's district attorney. When she was elected, there were few Black DAs in the country. Little has changed. Last year, only 1% of elected prosecutors were women of color. 79% were white men. She pulled it off by pulling together a coalition San Francisco hadn't seen before. Jim Stern says San Francisco was about a third liberal and a third more conservative Catholic and West Side voters.
So running in the middle was very difficult. And Kamala did it by assembling the most bizarre coalition, in the words of David Binder, our pollster. And he said the most bizarre coalition that he'd ever seen in San Francisco. If you look at the heat map of where she won, it was the Bayview Hunters Point, it was the Castro, and it was Pacific Heights. I mean, she united somehow Pacific Heights High Society, African-Americans in the Bayview, and LGBT community in the Castro.
Susie Loftus, who years later would be interim DA herself, worked on that campaign for Harris. She recalls the nastiness.
I think at that time, and even now, San Francisco has been referred to as more of a boys' town and a place where the guys are in charge. And they threw a lot of nastiness at her, but she was resolved to talk to every voter she could. And actually, Scott Wiener just gave this great story.
Scott Wiener's a state senator representing the Castro now. Back then, he was her colleague in the city attorney's office. She called him on election eve.
And Kamala called him up and said, "Where are voters going to be on a Monday night?" And he said, "Well, they'll be at the bars in the Castro." And the bar that Scott was going to bring her to was having underwear night. So there was a lot of gentlemen in underwear. And Scott sort of said, "You know, Kamala, I'm not sure if this is the bar you want to go into tonight." And she said to him, "Well, Scott, do people in underwear not vote?" And Scott was like, "No, they vote." And she's like, "Well, then I'd like to go talk to them." And she beelined right in and had a fabulous conversation with everybody on underwear night. And so I think what that shows is like, this was high stakes, very personal, nasty, all of that. But Kamala was driven by a belief in what she was doing and a willingness to work hard for it.
Harris's law enforcement background is a subject of attacks today. But when she took office in 2003, she took some of the most progressive stands of any district attorney in America, including a reentry program for first-time, low-level offenders that later became a national model. She was heralded as a gutsy, progressive leader, but she was also criticized for being too cautious and for not doing enough about police shootings of Black men. The thing about unusual coalitions is that they're fragile. There are always reasons why they're unusual. In Harris's case, the first big split came about 4 months in, when she declined to seek the death penalty in the shooting of Officer Isaac Espinosa, losing the cops. Much of the talk today of whether Harris is progressive or a prosecutor ignores the context of that time. That's what Alicia Garza told Joe on his It's All Political podcast this summer. She's an Oaklander who is the co-creator of Black Lives Matter.
I think the thing that is unique about Senator Harris is that she was not a prosecutor during the era of Black Lives Matter. And in fact, I'm maybe old enough to remember when she was being viciously attacked when she was the DA in San Francisco. You know, I mean, if you were to listen to the police unions, you would have thought she was Huey Newton.
But she forged ahead with her plans to remake the criminal justice system as, quote, smart on crime. Progressives liked some of her programs, like the one called Back on Track. It aimed to reduce recidivism by putting nonviolent, low-level offenders in a program where they performed community service and completed education courses. If they got a job and completed their requirements, their record was cleared. The small pilot program was deemed a success, and eventually it was copied across the state. Typically, 50% of low-level felons commit another crime. That number dropped to 10% among those who completed Back on Track. The Obama administration later adopted it as a national model.
But Harris's ideas weren't all winners with the lefty crowd.
So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy.
Harris found that most perpetrators of crimes were high school dropouts, so she created a program to keep them in school by threatening to jail parents of elementary school students if their kids missed more than 50 days in a year. Harris said the idea wasn't to criminalize parents, but to get them help before it was too late.
Well, this was a little controversial in San Francisco. And frankly, my staff went bananas. They were very concerned because we didn't know at the time whether I was going to have an opponent in my reelection race. But I said, look, I'm done. This is a serious issue, and I've got a little political capital, and I'm going to spend some of it.
She did take heat for the program, but no parents were ever put in jail in San Francisco, though there were arrests in other counties after the program was rolled out statewide. By 2009, truancy among elementary students in San Francisco had dropped 23%. And no opponent challenged her for re-election in 2007. That political capital had been well spent. Fellow prosecutor Susie Loftus.
She has her mom's like scientific mind. Like, what? Why is this happening? How do I get there? How do I fix it? And she follows the problem all the way through. And so I think when you think about truancy, it got criticized on the back end of like, well, what you're actually doing is you're targeting certain families. And what she worked with all of us on was like, no, there are certain families that are more impacted by these systems, and how can we get them the help that they need so those first graders are getting into class?
But her relationship with law enforcement took a long time to heal. She ran for state attorney general in 2010, and the major police unions endorsed her opponent, Los Angeles DA Steve Cooley. Harris won a squeaker that wasn't decided until 3 weeks after Election Day. Just as in San Francisco, she was the first woman and the first person of color to hold the job. She went on a campaign to win back the cops, visiting all 58 counties in California and trying to make personal connections with law enforcement across the state. Here she is at an event in 2016 in Fresno, in California's deep red Central Valley, still making the case 5 years after she first visited as AG. And yeah, I know the sound isn't great here. I didn't know I was going to be using it in a podcast 4 years later.
Well, I am so glad to be back in Fresno today. And I want to specifically thank, of course, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, a great friend, but also...
And the police responded.
It's my honor, truly it is, to be standing next to the Attorney General, somebody I consider to be a personal friend and a professional friend. She, since the day she took office, has stayed in close communication with us.
Kamala Harris had learned a lesson from the Espinoza case, and she spent years trying to convince the cops she'd learned it. Here's how Susie Loftus describes her message.
I was new to the job. I was 100 days in, and if I knew then what I know now, I would have taken some more time. I would have put a process together, and I understand now how that hurt people, and I think she dug in on the right things, that this is a principled decision in line with the views of the people, but it also caused tremendous pain to this beautiful family and to the department and to all of the public safety, you know, folks in our community, and so I think she really, in the end, owned that she would have liked to have done the process differently.
Kamala Harris had become the highest-ranking law enforcement official in the state and the head of the largest Department of Justice outside of the one in Washington. That was episode one from the podcast Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris? From the San Francisco Chronicle. It first aired in 2020 and was reported by Joe Garofoli and Tal Copin, produced by King Kaufman. We'll have a link to the rest of their six-part series at klw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Up next, a writer explores her family's wrongful incarceration during World War II. It's a reading from New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour. Satsuki Ina lives in Albany. Her book is The Poet and the Silk Girl.
It's about my parents' experience as innocent prisoners of the U.S. government during World War II. Our family was among the 125,000 people of Japanese ancestry who were forcibly removed from their homes and unjustly incarcerated for reason of race alone after the U.S. declared war on Japan. This passage from the beginning of the book provides an overview of their story, which I've recovered in this family memoir by bringing together their letters, diary entries, and my father's haiku from the years leading up to and during their incarceration. I grew up knowing very little about my parents' World War II experience. Like others who had resisted and protested the injustice, they had been shamed into silence. Over their 4 years of captivity, my parents lived under assigned labels that created boundaries and definitions of who they were, what they did, and how they would be treated. By birthright, they were American citizens, but the war would justify their removal as non-aliens. Their demand for civil rights would render them disloyals. They would respond with despair as renunciants, and ultimately, they would be designated enemy aliens, subject to deportation. The dominant narrative that shaped my limited understanding was promoted by the perpetrator of the injustice, our American government. Simple dualities of loyal or disloyal, good guys or bad guys, have led to fractures in our community that remain today. I hope that this story, one of 125,284 stories, will give dignity to all those who found ways to protest and resist the dehumanizing trauma and staggering injustice of the World War II mass incarceration of Japanese Americans. Perhaps it can inform, and more importantly, inspire those who are protesting cruel and unjust incarceration today.
That was Albany author Satsuki Ina reading from her book, The Poet and the Silk Girl. It came out in March. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can find more readings from local authors at klw.org/newarrivals. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. Project 2025 is the conservative blueprint made for a Trump presidency, and analysts say its immigration policy is heavily inspired by one state.
It is partly fixated on California, like it's looking at its powers and how to go directly at California and the so-called sanctuaries it's created for various communities here.
What immigration under Project 2025 looks like, that's tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Michaela Sia, Christopher Alam, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadijo Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shirin Adil, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Henat Baba.